Good morning. You are listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and this is Monday morning. For those of you who are listening on the air, it's 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 100.7 in Corvallis, and KBOO.FM via the World Wide Web. This morning, we are excited. I am excited to have with us a couple of guests, Tanya March and Charles Chamberlain. Charles Chanquist, who are here to talk about a piece of Portland history that few people know, but is so interesting as we reflect upon who we are as a community and where we are going. It is important to remember our history as we seek to build a better community. God's Lake is an for me, at least, was a piece of history that I did not know about up until a few weeks ago. And I was told about this important, this fascinating piece of history. And I'm so glad to have with us our guest. Tanya wrote about this housing project as part of your research, part of a PhD.
Yeah, it was for a PhD in Urban Studies at Portland State University. Mm-hmm. It was my topic of my dissertation.
Excellent. And Charles was a resident there as a young child.
Yeah,
right?
I grew up in the project. Really, I moved in there when I was 10 years old. My family moved out my senior year of high school, so I lived there 6 years, and basically that was my growing up years.
Okay.
In a housing project.
Well, many of you might know that during World War II, Portland was a place where the shipbuilding industry was very important, and the Housing Authority of Portland built temporary housing to fill the influx of workers coming into the city. This piece of Portland history is important because it was an experiment, I suppose, in terms of how to gather people into community. And as part of our conversation, we'll talk about the housing patterns in Portland and in how it worked here in God's Lake Courts. Perhaps we should begin by, Tanya, maybe you can begin by telling us how you became interested in this project.
Well, I was originally looking at Columbia Villa during the Hope Six project, mm-hmm. and that had been built, the first 400 units there had been built as permanent public housing. When the Housing Authority of Portland was created 8 days after Pearl Harbor, there was a number of projects that came through the pipeline in 1942. And I was surprised that I'd never heard of God's Lake. You know, I started seeing these tables and charts that showed all of the names of all the housing projects. Vanport, I was very familiar with. University Homes, St. John's, the Kellogg Park, which is in the Clackamas Housing Authority, and to see the eighth largest housing project in the United States and having never heard of it or had no idea of what it looked like, I became curious. And my advisor, Carl Abbott, was concerned that there wouldn't be enough information. And I'm like a ferret, and I was like, I'm going to find information. And then Patricia Schlepter was also on the committee, was very concerned about how I was going to find people to talk to. And I basically started putting classified ads in the Oregonian, and I was able to interview about 30 residents of the housing project. I had hope. I mean, the place had a population of 10,000 people at a given point in time, so maybe 20,000 people total had lived there. Mm-hmm. I had some hope that some of them were still alive and willing to talk here in Portland. What I wasn't prepared for is I ended up doing a history of childhood, of growing up. And that Chuck is one of those.
Well, Charles, you grew up as an early child. Your family moved to Portland from where?
We came from Nebraska, from Omaha, Nebraska, moved here. My dad came to work in the shipyards, as most of the people that came to Giles Lake or to any of these housing projects to work in one of the four major shipyards in the Portland metropolitan area. This includes Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Vancouver had its own housing authority as well, McLaughlin Heights, and had temporary housing there as well. But there were four major shipyards, and then all the supporting industries that went with shipyards. There were, I think, three major steel fabricating factories right in the Giles Lake area. So that drew people from all over, and there were actually shipyards recruited nationally.
Yes.
And they would bring busloads of people out here. They would bring trains. Trains would be loaded with people coming to work in the shipyards because Portland had did not have the population to support that. Mm-hmm. And this is where the interesting thing comes. These people came from all over the country. I don't think there was ever any study of where they, what specific parts, but I could use my eighth grade graduating class as an example. Mm-hmm. There were 26 students in my eighth grade class at Giles Lake School. Only two were born in Oregon.
Wow.
The others came from 12 different states.
Mm. So this was a new community that was created because of?
Yeah, a brand new community of people who'd never lived together.
Mm-hmm.
The people from Oregon that I interviewed that moved into Giles Lake had been in the timber industry. So there were children that had been moved around from timber community to timber community. And as steel was needed, the way we gather timber in Oregon, which is to send out the railroad tracks and harvest the trees, that wasn't viable because that steel was needed for other industries. So a lot of people stopped.
Well, you could make more money in the shipyards than you could in the timber industry too. I mean, it was good pay for
It was better housing, according to the people I interviewed, than what you'd get in a timber town.
Now, Charles, for your family moving here from Nebraska, did they come here looking for work, or did your dad have a job here?
No, my dad didn't have a job, but my dad served in the First World War at Fort Vancouver Barracks across the river.
Mm-hmm.
He was from Nebraska, and he always wanted to come back to Portland. And that's one of the interesting things about the project. A lot of families moved here from a variety of economic situations and stayed here.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot who came as soon as the war was over. They packed up and went home because the housing project was temporary living.
Mm-hmm. It was designed to be temporary housing.
Yeah, you knew it wasn't going to survive. We were told it was going to be torn down. In fact, the units that we first moved into in July of 1943 were torn down a year later.
Mm-hmm.
They were only up a year.
Mm-hmm. Before we go on, maybe we should talk about where was Giles Lake exactly?
A sense of place.
Yeah, a sense of place, yes.
And Cecil, you said that you'd never heard of it. Well, as Tanya and I had been involved in a couple of the Slab Town festivals and did walking tours and so on, we found people who lived within three blocks of Giles Lake and lived there for years, lived up in the Willamette Heights area and so on, never knew there was a housing project. They look out every morning, get up, look out their windows, see all those buildings. They never knew people lived there one time. And we had people on that tour that time that said they were amazed that people actually lived there.
Mm-hmm. So where was it? The boundaries?
If give people in Portland to give a focal point, Montgomery Park in northwest Portland. And if you go straight west from Montgomery Park, you have Forest Hills, the Forest Park, the big forest area. It's at the base of that forest area, between the base of that forest area and the river. And from Montgomery Park, about a mile and a half west to where Eon Avenue or Highway 30 and St. Helens Road come together. That was basically the project area. There was an area of the project, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, along Front Avenue, that was contiguous to the project.
Mm-hmm.
But in that area, it's all now industrial area. Most people I talk to, I will say, do you know where the Portland Brewing Company is? They say, yeah, we know where that is. I said, that was right in the middle of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Right where the Lewis and Clark Exposition had been.
And that was the other thing, the 1905 Exposition used that area as the lake. That was kind of the, it wasn't a lake, it was a swamp.
Yeah.
It was.
Olmsted beautified it.
So after the 1905 exhibition, was that destroyed and was it vacant?
They sluiced from above using mining equipment, and then they dredged the river to fill it in.
But the area was actually not a lake.
Right.
And to make it a lake for the exposition, they actually cut a channel in from the river and flooded. The lake was only about 3 feet deep.
It was a riparian marsh.
Yeah, it showed this beautiful lake, but it was only about 3 feet deep, and there were never any boats on it.
No. And one of the reasons for selecting that site was because the streetcar ran to the Vaughn Street Ballpark.
Yeah.
And so that was between the Vaughn Street Ballpark and then the Forestry Center that had been left behind by the exposition. it was wonderful to hear children talk about this free museum and then these not holy cards that you get to go to baseball games on Thursdays.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KBOO-FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and we're speaking this morning about a piece of Portland history, Giles Lake Court. We're speaking with Charles Chonquist and Tanya March about this piece of Portland history. Speaking about this housing development, now this was by the Housing Authority of Portland built
this?
Okay.
This was a HAP housing project, yes.
And so who was eligible to move in there?
Someone who had at least one household member employed in the defense industry, and there was a long list of defense industry workers. That could be American Brake Shoe Company in Linton. It mm-hmm. could be the Kaiser Shipyards. It could be what's ESCO today, steel companies.
My mm-hmm. father was the warehouse manager for Richfield Oil Company, which had a dock in Linton.
Mm-hmm.
He also worked three nights a week as in the shipyards mm-hmm. as a crane operator.
Mm-hmm.
So the criteria, you had to have a job related to the war industry.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an approved list of employers.
Mm-hmm. One thing that we know about Portland history at this time, and you mentioned it, Charles, people moving into Portland because of the defense industry and needed to find housing. As people moved in from different parts of the country, I assume that there were people of a variety of backgrounds and experiences. Mm-hmm. One thing I was familiar with, at least a little part, was that before the war, there was a very small black population in Portland,
yes.
Oregon.
Yeah.
And part of this buildup, a lot of more African Americans moved in from the South.
Yeah, it was a lot of good work opportunity,
mm-hmm.
Paid well, and there were a lot of African Americans that were a part of that influx, that migration to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And so the migration obviously ended up in housing projects, because housing, even before the war, was pretty tight around the city and was also basically still segregated.
Mm.
And there was only three housing projects that allowed African Americans into. I mean, the mm-hmm. pre-war population in the Oregon, basically Portland, was 1,800
mm-hmm.
blacks. And during the war peak, it was about 20,000. Mm-hmm. And the housing projects that housed the majority of that were Vanport, which stands for Vancouver, Portland. So it was mm-hmm. in between the two cities. The largest housing project to house African Americans, and the only one in Portland city limits, was Giles Lake Courts.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also a small population out at Fairview Homes, which were all working for an aluminum factory out in Troutdale.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for, they provided 20% of all the aluminum needed for airplane construction, mm-hmm. which was used by Boeing.
So as these people moved in from Nebraska, from Arizona,
I'll just give you the rundown for my class. Louisiana, Minnesota, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Iowa, Texas, Missouri. Those mm-hmm. It came from kind of the Midwest, the spine of the country. So that.
Now continue talking.
So, it came from – many of these people came from rural communities
mm-hmm.
Because it was a job opportunity, greater, and they paid well.
Yes, yes.
Relatively.
So in terms of these people coming from different parts of the country, trying to live together with new people far away from their homes, and let's talk about the patterns of integration or non-integration in terms of housing. So was Giles Lake an integrated community?
Giles Lake was not built as an integrated community. There were three sections of the project in which African Americans were segregated to live.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is nothing else was segregated. The schools were white, were integrated. I was in a Boy Scout troop that was probably one-third African-Americans, two-thirds Caucasian. And we met together. We had I had two African-American friends in my patrol.
Is that the fire brigade or the
junior
patrol?
No, this is Boy Scouts. This is Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. Fire brigade had the same thing, kids in the grade schools.
The schools was integrated?
Schools were very integrated. Mm-hmm. My best friend through all through high school was an African-American. Mm-hmm. Shall we just take this?
Go for it.
Natural? Mm-hmm. It was interesting because it was a laboratory in natural integration.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing really important is that the parents were at work 6 days a week, mm-hmm. and these children maybe didn't necessarily have the views of their parents, and they were able to mingle freely and just through the school and through the housing. Yeah. There wasn't a greater authority telling them how to behave.
No. And the African Americans were mixed into the workforce. It wasn't – there was this group working here and this group working here. You ride the bus to work, and it was a mixture of African Americans and whites.
And there was a greater evil. The axis.
That's right. And
you had to come together as a community. It was crusading children, saving stamps.
And I think the exciting – to me, I use myself as kind of a model in this, and I shouldn't do this. But I came from a white community. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Omaha, grew up in a Scandinavian neighborhood. The only time I ever saw an African-American is if I happened to go downtown and someone was in the store. I didn't know. In fact, Mom said the first time I ever saw one, I was scared. I didn't know what it was.
Right.
And came from a time of traditional, not, I wasn't taught, but it was traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I came and went to school with African Americans.
Right.
And we had kids from Oklahoma who probably had more of a segregational concept, but we all came together in one room. Mm-hmm. And we did things together. Albert Moore, who was my best friend through Giles Lake, had a paper out. Every morning we got together at the Rod Shack and got our papers.
Mm-hmm.
We did things together. Anything that went on in school included everybody. Baseball was the big thing in the project. Everybody played baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But there was only one baseball field in the project, and that was at the grade school. And Saturdays and Sundays, we would have a pickup game that would go for like noon on Saturday, would run all day Saturday and pick up the next morning, Sunday morning, and go till dark on Sunday. And it was literally the whites playing the blacks.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't – if one team didn't have enough players, you'd mix it up. And we played like 8 to 9 hours a day or in the weekend. It was high school kids, college-age kids, adults. It was a pickup game. Whoever – there was a place to go in and play. We did our own umpiring. We did this for 3 years, and I played all 3 years, and I can never remember any racial incidents, fights, anything. It was, and I can still remember some of the guys I played with.
Excellent. Let me say that you are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO FM. We're speaking about the Giles Lake Court and housing in Portland during World War II. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, and we'll go to Joanne. Good morning, Joanne.
For this history, because I've been learning through the years a lot about history and other things from cable that I didn't learn in school now. But anyway, I have a question. I live, I got a shoulder pain. I live in public apartment, public housing in Portland, and I wanted to ask if there is an Oregon housing authority. Here's the reason why I'm asking. In my building, the last few years, we've been getting a lot of people of color and young people moving in my building, and I guess it's because of the a lot of things. But anyway, here we got a flyer the other day in here saying that the Housing Authority of Portland is going to change our public housing in this building or in the apartment buildings to a Section 8 voucher project. And to me, this smells of privatization. Sorry about that. But I know I don't want to interrupt your history, but I just wanted to put that out in case you might want to respond. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you, Joanne. It's beyond the scope of this program right now, but speaking about the Housing Authority of Portland.
When Columbia Villa was torn down, there was the 400 permanent defense housing project part that was torn down. So Columbia Villa is the only permanent housing project built in 42. There had been 80 additional infills. And when that was torn down, they only replaced 400 in site, and they made the other 80 into a Section 8 voucher. So it is what happens.
What happens, yeah. And Columbia Villa is now, what is it called, that area? It's not no longer Columbia
Villa. It's not the
Villa.
Yeah.
Okay.
New Columbia?
New Columbia, something like that. Okay. Well, I wanted to hear more, but Charles, in terms of growing up, and you mentioned you know, people coming from different communities, learning to live together. And as a child growing up, you had people, friends of different backgrounds. How did the adults get along? You know, they probably came with preconceptions of different people. Were they forced to get along because of this common effort? Or?
Yeah, I think Tanya hit on one thing. There was a greater evil,
mm-hmm.
and everybody worked to defeat that greater evil in where they're doing. Obviously, there were rubs from people who were basically prejudiced in their thinking,
mm-hmm.
but it forced people together.
Mm-hmm. Once you start rubbing elbows, you have to reevaluate your preconceptions about people.
Sure. There's another interesting dimension of this. This big housing project, which was the largest housing project in the country, war housing project in the country, built within a city limits. Yet, and it had a defined geographic area. It didn't meld into any other neighborhoods. It was in this industrial area defined by the hills and the river. 10,000 people living there at its height. It had no infrastructure.
Five community centers.
They had five community centers. It had no stores, no banks, no post offices.
No movie theater.
No movie theaters, no service stations, nothing. So all of your commerce, when you had to shop, you got on the bus. Yeah. And most people didn't have cars. We lived in the housing project for 5 years, never had a car.
Mm-hmm.
We rode the bus. So you rode the bus to the store up by Montgomery Ward to a Safeway store.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there were African-American moms and their kids going to the same store,
mm-hmm.
and riding the same bus and doing the same things.
And you had rationing.
And rationing, yeah. That was common with everybody.
Everyone, yes.
And if you wanted something, you had to go up into the Northwest Portland area, basically what we know as Stumptown.
Slabtown.
Slabtown.
Mm-hmm.
Up in the Slabtown area to do your shopping.
Mm-hmm.
So there was kind of an integration there, and I remember there's a store on 23rd and Thurman,
mm-hmm.
it's called Fisher's Grocery Store, and Mom liked to go there. It wasn't Safeway, so we went down there, and there was always African American families in the same store.
Right. Excellent. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, please give us a call. And we have one caller online, and let's go to Dave. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. Fabulous show, incidentally. Hello?
Yes, yes.
Fabulous show.
Thank you.
I want to just concur with what the guest said. You know, when I'm probably close to 50 years old, and not probably, but probably the same age as your guest. And
thank you.
I could remember when I was growing up in California, we used to, I lived in a kind of a semi-poor area, and we had a lot of African Americans that I went to school with. We used to play baseball with, football, and we never ever had any kind of issues with racism. And oh, you'd have the occasional, you know, slur come out, but nothing like we see today. I think part of the reason we have the racism today is, number one, I think people like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton are basically, in my opinion, just poverty pimps who are propagating this so that they can have a job. And I think our president has caused more division in this nation than ever before. I
so,
mean,
Dave,
can you address that?
Okay. Thank you.
What's your opinion about that?
Thank you for your call. This is a familiar caller who has concerns about the origins of racism in our society. Any reflections on in terms of growing up, in terms of tensions?
It wasn't all roses here in the city of roses.
I don't want to paint that picture because there were problems. There were obvious problems.
Right.
But I guess I take it from point of going forward. I was 10 years old.
Right.
I was formed by this experience.
Right.
Both in the housing project and in high school and in college. I had an African American roommate in college who was one of my best friends in high school.
Mm-hmm.
My whole understanding of race was formed in that housing project. I asked Tanya if I should tell the story, and I think maybe I will. Okay. My best friend was Albert Moore. Albert was, his family came here from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Obviously, they came out of a society that was very segregated. Albert was a neat kid, and we did a lot together. We were in the Boy Scout troop together. He carried papers. We carried papers. The first year, and by the way, Giles Lake had no grade school. At its height in 1943, we all went to Chapman Grade School up on, and Chapman Grade School was built for 750 students. It was, before the war, it was running about 600. The one year that all the students from, all the kids from Giles Lake went to Chapman, there were 1,600 students in Chapman. They were running split shift. The kids from the regular neighborhood, Chapman neighborhood, went from 8 o'clock in the morning to 12:15. The students from Giles Lake went from 12:30 to 5 o'clock. And we weren't bused up there. We rode public transportation. They just put extra buses on, and I had to pay 4 cents a day to ride the bus to go to school. But they had buses that would come to school and pick us up. But Albert and I and a couple of my buddies all had paper routes. So we would ride our bikes to school, which is about a two-mile ride from where we lived, and get out and go home and carry papers. But one of the routines when we went up there was there was a really nice restaurant across a little working place restaurant across the street from Montgomery Ward, and they had great milkshakes and great hamburgers. So we'd ride up and stop and have, because we were making money and we had money, we could stop and have lunch. So we would go and have lunch. But Albert would never go with us. But they had great hamburgers and great milkshakes. So we kept saying, hey, Albert, these are really great. So he finally, one day, he acquiesced and decided, well, he'd go with us. So we went in, and there were probably maybe 8 or 9 tables, and we had a table by the door, and we all ordered our hamburgers. As a waitress is coming around, she came to Albert, and she said, we don't serve niggers in here. And We were stunned. Albert didn't say anything. He got up and left. Nobody said anything. We sat there, and all of a sudden the waitress brought the hamburgers and milkshakes and set them down. One of the guys said, "I can't eat this." And we got up and left. From then on, we rode our bikes to school with Albert and ate our lunch at school. We experienced segregation mm-hmm. at our heart,
yes.
not our mind. We understood what was wrong because my friend was discriminated against. You didn't have to have someone hold a sign up and tell us that was wrong. And that became part of my life. And I think that happened to a lot of us in that experiment of integration without rule.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to our callers, and I thank you for sharing that story, someone asked, I think I refer to it as an experiment and wanted to know, experiment by whom? And by the housing authority, by the shipping industry, by the people in that community?
I don't think there was any intentional. I think it happened because people were forced together.
Right.
Okay. There was a lot of reports coming out of World War I that men tended to only stay for 6 months mm-hmm. because they returned to their families, that even for as much money as you could give them, that they wanted to be reunited with their families. And because there was no housing, they would leave. And there was a lot of money lost in training because it takes a lot of money and you're in war urgency. We're near the Bonneville Dam, so we had a lot of electrical use mm-hmm. that could just come in very cheap. And they needed to keep the people here. And all the research from the industry from World War I was they had failed to provide housing. So there had been social ideas on how to build this housing, and it had come out of the failed efforts in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think such a push. And, the Housing Authority of Portland in this particular housing project with Goslick is different than Vanport City. Vanport City probably had a lot more social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
You had Henry Kaiser, but particularly your son, Edward Kaiser, really working with one architect, really designing phenomenal. They were very upset with the federal nursery schools because they wouldn't open early enough mm-hmm. for their needs. They really wanted 24-hour daycare. So they built two separate daycare centers mm-hmm. on that hub and spoke. There was a lot – there's this sort of experimental social engineering is much more prevalent in the Vanport than it was here mm-hmm. or many other housing projects. And that's because a private individual was really putting his fingers in the pot.
Excellent. Well, we have a slew of callers, so let's try to get to
that's
them.
That's great.
Okay. Patrice, good morning. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question. I don't know if you guys, I just kind of tuned in a little bit later in the show. If you guys have already talked about kind of the post-war, what happened after the war with the housing development at Giles Lake and what kind of was the sentiment around the city with, these kind of experimental, is that what we're calling it, experimental?
All right. Hey, excellent.
Very good question.
Yeah.
Patrice, what happened first as soon as the war ended, a lot of people were able to move out, and you ended up having at Giles Lake Courts and at other housing projects, a lot of single women moving in, and when I started my research, didn't realize how high the divorce rate was after the war. Families really broke apart. Mm-hmm. And I thought at first the people I was talking to that had grown up as children, that it was unusual that they had so many step-parents. And it turns out that it wasn't. I went and actually looked at the census data. And just as we protect women and children now as a protected class when you go to look for fair housing law, there wasn't fair housing law. So women with children and African Americans faced greater discrimination in the private housing market and tended to flood into these housing authority projects that had been built as defense but started to be affordable housing project that didn't discriminate unlike the private market. Mm. And then we had another phase happen in 1948 for Giles Lake Courts when the Memorial Day flood at Vanport occurred and transpired. That was a population originally of 40,000. It whittled down to maybe 30,000. There was a huge amount of displacement.
There was 14,000 living in Vanport when the flood. So, but there were 14,000 all of a sudden without homes, mm-hmm. and without any place to live. And Giles Lake was built as a temporary, and in fact, there's a big sign that we have that, that Tanya found that says Giles Lake Court's temporary war housing.
You can go see it at some Miniman's on 23rd at the tavern.
So this, it was not intended to be permanent, and everybody who moved in, it was to me, it was kind of like an army. I didn't know anything about the army until I served in the army. It was kind of like an army experience. Mm-hmm. Experience. You knew you weren't going to be there forever, so you never grabbed on it. Nobody moved in there thinking, "Well, I'm going to stay here." Everybody, any family moved in, knew that sometime I'd be moving out. So it had a little to do with your how you thought about it. But after Vanport flood and the people were living in Vanport, and that had started to be considered more of a permanent space because Portland State's, the Vanport Extension Center, the beginning of Portland State was located there.
It wasn't leased land.
Yeah.
Giles Lake Courts was leased land from families like the Hoffmans, from railroad companies, from Pacific Chain and Manufacturing, from Montgomery Wards. Vanport, the land on which it was sitting, although it was temporary construction, similar construction, no foundations, was actually owned by the federal government. And so there was actually people moving out from Giles Lake to Vanport.
Yeah, people were moving into Vanport even in the 47, 48, where Giles Lake was all exit.
Okay. That's a little bit of information, Patrice, I hope is helpful.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, but let's go to our next caller. Good morning. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
This is a very good subject matter concerning the history of Portland. And I was curious. Every time I would go to, like, the Jansen Beach Mall, I would see, I kind of sense, and I'm in somewhat history, I see a lot of older pictures and all that of what Jansen Beach used to be in the Hayden Island area. Mm-hmm. What's the overall history of that area of Northeast Portland during and after the war period?
Well, I'll cover it a little bit for the war period. There was something called the Public Accommodation Law that stood in the book until, I believe, 1958, that made it impossible for African Americans from the Vanport Housing Project and from Giles Lake Housing Project to use the swimming pools out at Jansen Beach. And there was only particular days that they could go to hear jazz music. I was surprised because if there was an African American performing, that did not necessarily mean the audience was allowed to be African American. There was different clubs rotated during the war years, the nights in which African Americans could go and listen to live music and gather in the city.
Wow.
So Jansen Beach had a history. It was an amusement park, and you've seen those pictures.
Yes, yes, it was interesting. And I mean, how did Jansen Beach handle the adaptation between the two cultures after the post-war period, and how did things fan out in the 50s or let's say the early 60s or something like that, as far as anyone on the distinguished panel knows? I mean, the guests.
Well, I mean, I know about the rules that were enforced until 58.
Well, I don't know about the dance clubs and the things like that. I was still in high school. But I do know that we used to have a paper carrier what carried Oregonian newspaper route. And all the paper carriers had one Sunday a year when they'd all go out to Jansen Beach swimming. And I know that Albert went along every time we went, so I never remember him being told he couldn't go on the pool.
I know another newspaper group went down to Seaside, and he was allowed. There was an African American newspaper carrier who was allowed in the pool by himself for 15 minutes, and that it really upset all the newspaper because they'd gone down to Seaside for the day.
Yeah.
Okay, that was very insightful. Thank you very much for your time and thanks a lot, Cecil, and thanks to the panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack. And we have another caller. Michael, good morning.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I have some people in Vanport, but Northeast Portland ultimately, what black people settled in Northeast Portland was ultimately from the Vanport flood. And I want to say that the new Vanport flood today in Northeast Portland is gentrification. So it doesn't stop. I mean, black people then came from slavery to integration. Now we're dealing with gentrification. And racism is still alive and well. And also, too, there's no middle-class black community in Oregon today. So we still haven't attained any level of advancement. And also, one last question. You know, when you talk about experiment, democracy is an experiment. Mm-hmm. Anything that hasn't attained perfection is an experiment. So we're still in the experiment stages in a so-called democratic society. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, I think how that KB learned about myself was through the Black History Month mm-hmm. efforts of city employees volunteering. And there was an exhibit that was up called Lost Black Neighborhoods that was in Kaiser Town Hall. And it's going to be moving to PCC. And it talks not only about Vanport and Giles Lake Courts and Fairview, but also talks about Laurel Albina Memorial Coliseum and some of the other urban renewal. Because a lot of the people I interviewed, Giles Lake isn't any more temporary for an African-American than other housing because they everywhere they moved, some of these people moved 12 times in their childhood. And Ed Washington, who spoke at the Lost Black Neighborhoods event, I'm hoping to get that up on YouTube when he talked, because he ended up at Giles Lake Courts in the trailers. When you're a kid, it's an adventure. Mm. It was not an adventure for their parents. Mm-hmm. It was pretty miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I would second that. I look at it from a kid standpoint.
Sure.
And what it did to me, what other adults had to struggle with, I didn't experience.
Right.
So I can't speak to that. I can speak to relationships in the African American community, whether it was in Giles Lake or, in fact, in Albina. After I went to high school, I went to Benson High School. I graduated in 1950. There were 14 African Americans in my graduating class. Five of them were good friends. We played ball together, and we have kept contact. We get together three times a year, and most of those guys are still there. And so I had a relationship with established, and all these, by the way, except for one, were established African-American families from the community before the war.
And we were talking about how Chapman did double shifting, and there was the 1,600 students there. Mm-hmm. One of the other reasons Portland Public Schools built the Giles Lake School was because 300 students were truants. And from what I could tell, they were all from the African-American section. So just because in the classroom things are getting along, parents from the South were afraid to send their kids to public school at first. And that's one of the reasons why that school was built. Mm-hmm. And also they had lower grades at the community center as a way to resolve these problems so that they'd be closer.
I did. In fact, I found an article that you hadn't seen. So those community center nursery schools were initially built by the housing project as nursery schools. But because of the weight of students going to Chapman School and kindergarten kids getting up at going to school at noon and coming home at 5 o'clock.
When
it was dark. They said, let's try to keep the younger kids on projects. So they turned the nursery schools into kindergarten and first grade for the first couple of years, and eventually when Giles Lake School was built. By the way, Giles Lake School was built in the spring of 1944. It opened in the fall of 1944. It had 1,000 students in it the day it opened.
Wow. Yeah,
and it was built right across the street from one of the segregated housing sections of the project.
44th Court.
So it was contiguous to that, and so I think what Tanya said, that Chapman School situation was very temporary, but it was a lot of, as they moved in, I'm not going to go to school, I'm not going to, you know, and I'm not going to do that. And so a lot of them didn't go to school.
Yeah. We have a lot of callers in a few minutes. Before we go to our next caller, let me remind you that you are listening to KBOO. At 9 is the Omo Variety Hour. Topics are the new Middle East. Can Egypt lead the way to democracy and healthy development? Protests in Wisconsin, reform or revolutionary change? And what is political hip-hop? At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, the president of Friends of Family Farmers talk about the Agricultural Reclamation Act. At 11 on Sounds of Awareness, the guest is Dale Campbell, who is blind and started his own online shopping service out of frustration with customer service at a local mall. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, Chris Andre speaks with Susan Lindauer, whistleblower and author of Extreme Prejudice, the terrifying story of the Patriot Act and the cover-ups of 9/11 in Iraq. We are talking about Giles Lake Project, a housing project in northwest Portland that was temporary during the Second World War. Our guests are here, and we'll go to our next caller. Jeff, good morning. Jeff was calling from North Portland.
Good morning, Cecil, and thanks for taking my call. Thanks for an exciting program and very interesting history lesson. I live in inner North Portland, and not, in fact, around the corner from what was once the Cleo and Lily Ann Club, where even luminaries like B.B. King performed in the 1960s and 70s, trying to fill in that 60s and 70s bit of history just a touch. I also draw a cartoon every month for the Northwest Examiner across the river in Northwest Portland. Mike Ryerson has some great history of that neighborhood as well. But I swim almost every day at the Matt Dishman Center in one of the most integrated environments one can imagine, and what a pleasure it is to recreate with my friends and neighbors, my neighbors who have become my friends. But I wanted to be very brief and state this fundamental philosophical reality for me, which is, what is the opposite of integration? And the answer is this: disintegration. And unless we can integrate, we will surely disintegrate. Thanks for letting me make that statement.
Thank you, Jeff.
Have a great day.
Jeff mentioned Mike Ryerson, who lived in the neighborhood and went swimming at the old Cooch Pool, which is now MLC Cooch Pool. And he told a story about Swede Holbrook at the pool. I know Chuck was friends with Swede. Swede went on to be a famous basketball player.
Basketball player. First 7-foot player probably in Oregon.
Mm. And
played at Oregon State.
And he played it for Lincoln High, and he lived at Giles Lake Courts. And Mike Ryerson one time said that he saw Swede in the pool, but he couldn't figure out how the kid was standing and not treading water and wasn't drowning, because Mike just saw his head. And so Mike Ryerson's very aware of this work, and he's part of the Slabtown Festival, where we have a lot of the reunions for Giles Lake Courts residents.
Excellent. Oh, so you have reunions for the older residents?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Tanya started this about maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah, so.
Oh, wonderful.
There's a Slabtown Festival every September. Mm-hmm. It's held down on the 23rd Street area, and there are a variety of venues of thinking. And one of them was, she was working with starting on her study of Giles Lake, and it was a good opportunity to bring people together who had lived in Giles Lake.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a number came the first year, and every year that they have it, we have kind of a reunion. And it's fun. Tanya and I took a group down and walked the industrial area, and I was able to point out where things were.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a couple streets down there. There's Guam Street is still Guam Street. It was the street that I lived on.
And I videotaped it in some of the tours on YouTube.
Excellent.
People want to see Chuck out in the hood.
All right. thank you for videotaping. Thank you, YouTube. We have two more callers. Let's see if we can get them in. Before we go, good morning.
Good morning,
Bob. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Here.
Yes.
Good show. Interesting. I'm sorry I missed the first part of it, but a great history lesson for Portland residents, new and old. Your woman guest talked about a lot of single women and divorced women being discriminated against for housing and being able to live in these developments you're talking about. I'm sure a lot of those were also war widows, not only divorced persons, but they had a real hard time after the war because their financial structure and their family structure was broken, as well as their living situation. And it's nice to hear of an inclusive neighborhood for people to go to. So I appreciate your talk, and I'll let you get to your next guest. Bye.
Thank you, Bob.
I'm glad he mentioned that. I left it out.
Thank you. Let's go to our next caller. And we'll try again. Yolanda, good morning.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Yolanda. I'm calling from Southeast Portland. I wanted to make a comment in regards to something the your panel guest had mentioned, the experience that he had when he was a younger kid, and he went to the restaurant to have these delicious hamburgers and milkshakes. Well, I just wanted to point out that I really feel that not only was the African-American kid, his friend, discriminated against, but he personally, himself, and the other young kids there were discriminated against. Because the African-American kid, having like heart of the African-American kid and like mind of the African-American kid, they all were offended. So but discrimination just didn't happen to blacks. They happened to other people who were against the negative activity of discrimination. That's the first point I wanted to make. And the second point I wanted to make is kind of a stretch, but I really do feel that people continue to feel discriminated against, mainly because of the economic disparity within the black community as compared to non-African-American community. That also is to say that more than 50% of the African-American community here in Portland are unemployed. And that's substantial to be, happening within inside of one group of people who happen to be black. So with that in mind, you know, blacks throughout the history in Portland, you know, really feel more so the disparity in the quality of living because of the economic disparity in being able to get a job that pays reasonable and or to be promoted within a company and or to be recognized within the community as time has went on. Would you like to comment on that, Cecil?
Okay, well, thank you, Yolanda, for bringing that up and reminding us of that and the ongoing struggle that black people here in Oregon and indeed throughout the nation continue to face in terms of housing and employment and education. It's something that continues. Thank you, Yolanda. Right.
Thank you.
We have about a couple of minutes and we need to wind up. And there is so much here. You mentioned, Tanya, that an exhibit is going to be moved to PCC.
Yes, the exhibit that the contact would be Tim Hall from the Portland City Water Bureau for that. But it was part of a group effort of the Black History Month Committee. Mm-hmm. That it was a volunteer work that has been going on for many years. Donnie Adair and a number of other people are very active in that group.
Great, great. And Charles, you are a historian, a living historical figure here in Oregon. And also, I noticed you have this book of your own writing about Giles Lake. Are you going to share it with others, or are you going to speak anywhere?
No, I've just Tanya's kind of inspired me, but one of the things I really felt, Giles Lake had been lost in history because several major pieces of Oregon Historical Society Quarterly that did some 23 pages on that area, and there were about two paragraphs about it being a housing project.
Mm.
And I just felt that, and others now are stepping forward and saying, this is an area of significant part of our history, although it was only 9 years.
Excellent. Well, thank you both for just sharing this piece of information and history of Portland. I'm, you know, as an amateur history nerd, I'm fascinated by this, and I'm just going to make sure I try to stay in contact with you to learn more. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
And thank you listening to KBOO. Stay tuned for more community radio.